When does a phenomenon become the unknown? When all attempts at understanding fail, and those who thirst for knowledge and understanding watch as research turns to ash in their mouth. As the phenomenon turns from a riddle to be solved into anomalous fascination. Hello, friends. Thank you for tuning in to episode 5 of the Anomalous Fascination podcast. Again, I want to thank you all so much for your continued support, your extremely kind words, and your suggestions for future episodes. As always, word of mouth is the best way to let people know about this show, so if you love the show or even just find it interesting, tell a friend about it, and maybe they'll find what you found. That the unknown is incredible. I mentioned before about suggestions for future episodes, and I must say that this episode is, in fact, a suggestion from a listener. So thank you to my cousin Will for mentioning this as a possible topic. I put it on my very long list of future topics, expecting I'd cover it sometime down the line. Once I started reading about it, I couldn't put it down. And so now, due to my own anomalous fascination, I'd like to share it with you. Let's start at the beginning. The date was November 30th, 1948. It was a warm evening on Somerton Beach, just south of Adelaide, Australia, when around 7 p.m., a local jeweler named John Lyons was taking a casual stroll at the beach with his wife. As they were walking towards the local town of Glenelg, they noticed something a bit strange. They barely noticed in passing a very well-dressed man lying on the sand with his head propped up a bit on the seawall, which would not have been unusual except for the strong evening heat and the fact that he was lying on a beach in the sand. The couple was about 50 feet away and saw the man extend his right arm upward and then let it fall back down, as they assumed the man was drunk and likely smoking a cigarette. So they continued on with their evening. About half an hour later, another couple noticed the same man, once again finding his attire odd, given how well-dressed he was for a beach. They, unlike the other couple, did not see him moving, but rather assumed he'd been passed out from a long night of drinking, as many mosquitoes were surrounding his face, but he seemed to pay them no mind. The evening passed and morning arrived when John Lyons, who had noticed the man the night before, was passing by that part of the beach when he saw a crowd of people gathered around where the drunk man had been. As he came closer, he saw that the crowd was surrounding the man, who was still there from the night before. Cold, dead, and with no marks to indicate any sort of violent attack, and a half-smoked cigarette on his chest. So, what is it about this man, a man who died 72 years ago from a seemingly non-violent death, that has me and so many others obsessed with it? Because after 72 years, despite decades of investigation, no one has any idea who that man was. Let's take a stroll, shall we? A few hours later, the body was rushed to the Royal Adelaide Hospital, where the attending physician declared his time of death around 2 a.m., and that the cause of death was heart failure. Then, unusually enough, the physician stated that he suspected poisoning as part of the equation. Then they began looking to identify the man, finding on his person train tickets from Adelaide to the beach, a pack of chewing gum, some matches, two combs, and a pack of Army Club cigarettes that contained 7 cigarettes of a different brand of cigarette called Concetus. They found no ID, no wallet, no cash, and oddly, no tags or labels of any kind on his clothing, as all of them had been carefully cut off with scissors. The only notable thing that was discovered about his clothes was that a pocket had been repaired using some very unusual orange thread. The police were now involved and were hoping that the autopsy could shine some light on their John Doe, But all they found was a rough-looking liver, a stomach filled with his last meal, a pastry, and a considerable amount of blood in his stomach. This once again pointed them towards poison, but they tested his blood numerous times and no traces of poison were found. The coroner was still required by his job to find a cause of death and sought guidance from various professionals, including a particular well-renowned professor who advised that it is possible that a very rare poison was used, one which decomposes very quickly after death, leaving no evidence. One of the two suggested poisons is called strophanthin, which is an extremely rare poison found in an African plant, often used by tribes in Somalia for poison arrows. Pretty strange for just a random guy on a beach in Australia, huh? But again, there was no way to document this poison being involved. It was just his only answer for how a man could be poisoned, but then show no signs of poison. The police continued to investigate, circulating the fingerprints they had obtained throughout Australia and in the entire English-speaking world. But no one could identify them. They even began sending requests out for local Adelaide citizens to start coming to view the corpse, to see if possibly any of them have known the man. But again, no such luck. By mid-January, the police had essentially worn out every lead they had, so they began a wider search in order to find if there were any abandoned possessions, luggage, etc., that could possibly be tied to this man. Which, if you're thinking, that seems like finding a needle in a haystack, you're right. But oddly enough, it worked. The railway station, which the man had a ticket from, contacted the police to advise of a brown suitcase that was left behind there on November 30th. Bingo. Pursuing this lead, the police both reviewed the contents of the case and spoke with employees, all of whom had no recollection of the man. The suitcase would not end up being as helpful as they thought, but they could confirm it was the man's suitcase, as they did find the very unusual orange thread in the suitcase that had been applied to the pocket of the dead man's pants. Inside, once again, tags and stickers had been torn off to provide no information, except for three pieces of clothing that bore the name Keane, K-E-A-N. The police were unable to trace anyone by this name, and concluded that someone had purposely left them on because this was not the name of the deceased. The other items were as random and innocuous as those found on the deceased. A stencil kit, table knife, and a coat with American stitchwork. The police, once again, found themselves at a standstill. They called in another expert named John Cleland to re-examine the body and all of his possessions, just to see if they'd missed anything. So it was April of 1949, over 4 months after the body's discovery, that Cleland found a small secret pocket sewn into the waist of the man's pants. Within the pocket was found one of the most gripping pieces of evidence yet. A tightly rolled, tiny scrap of paper, which upon unfurling the scrap, they discovered two words. Tamam Shud. T-A-M-A-M-S-H-U-D. This phrase was released to the press by the police as they hoped to find anyone who could find meaning or any connection to this phrase. A local police reporter from the Adelaide paper contacted them saying this was not a name, but a Persian phrase in a popular Persian book of poetry. He advised the police to obtain a copy of Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, and I did not check my pronunciation on that, so I apologize in advance. This was a 12th century book that had become popular in Australia during World War II. Upon obtaining the book, the police reviewed the entire works, looking for this phrase in the book, only to find that it was the final two words of the book, Tamam Shud, translated in English to, "It is ended." With this new discovery, the police now considered this a suggestion that it could have been suicide, something they had long considered in addition to foul play, which is part of the reason the police never turned this missing person case into a full-blown murder investigation, because no one could ever say it was murder. The police finally were at the point where the body had to be buried due to decomposition. They prepared it to be sealed under concrete in dry ground, in case they needed to exhume it in the future. Before the body went, though, they did make sure to take a cast of both the head and upper torso of the man for future identification efforts. This investigation continued as they now tried to locate the exact copy of the book that had these words stripped from them. In late July, a man from Glen Elg walked into the station with a strange story. In early December, he and his brother-in-law had taken a drive in his car, which was regularly parked near Somerton Beach. While in the car, the brother-in-law found a copy of the Rubaiyat book lying on the floor in the back seat. And both of them had seen it and just quietly assumed that the other had been the owner of the stray book. When they read the article about the investigation, however, they both looked at each other, walked out to the car to grab the book, and as they flipped through the pages, they reached the final page, in which part of the page, including the final two words of the page, had been ripped out of this copy. With this book now in their possession, they found some clues extremely helpful. Finding both a phone number written on the rear cover, and with the help of a magnifying glass, some faint impressions of capitalized letters beneath the phone number. The number was unlisted, but they were able to connect it to a young woman who lived near Somerton Beach. This woman, nicknamed Jestin in lieu of providing her actual name, stated that she had presented a copy of the book to a man she had known during the war, which sent the detectives to search for an Alfred Boxall. Could this have been the deceased? Well, you already know the answer to that. The police quickly found out this was not their John Doe, but rather a man who lived in New South Wales, and still did live there because he was very much alive. This man also possessed a copy of the book with the woman's number on it, but the copy was completely intact. Returning to the woman, Jestin, the police did some light questioning of her and got a few tidbits, but did little probing after that, which was odd, given her being the only direct connection to this book, and the fact that when the detective showed her the cast of the dead man's face, she was so taken aback by it that she almost fainted. It was clear from her reaction that she likely recognized the man, but firmly denied this being anyone she knew. So with the phone number on the book exhausted as a resource, the detective turned to the faint impression of letters hidden behind the phone number. Using ultraviolet light, 5 lines of jumbled letters were identified, along with various other markings. It appeared to be some sort of indecipherable code. Despite only having a small sample of lines to go off of, they sent this set of letters and markings off to Naval Intelligence and allowed it to be published everywhere by the press in the hopes of someone having a promising lead or solution to the code. Despite the best minds and many amateur code breakers on the job, everyone came up empty, with the Navy stating that the code was unbreakable. And that, essentially, was where the case rested. All leads exhausted, obviously I disagree, but you know, hindsight being 20/20 and all that. When the coroner finally published the results of his investigation in 1958, 10 years after the victim's death, his report concluded with the following. Quote, "I am unable to say who this deceased was. I am unable to say how he died or what the cause of death was." End quote. And so it would lie for years to come, despite a Herculean effort by the authorities in trying to find any information possible, they were left completely and utterly stumped. So, is there anything we've been able to learn about this case in the past 60 years? Stay tuned after this break to find out more. So what is it that we're missing with this case? The case of a person who would become known as the Somerton Man. We've been left with a pile of seemingly useless evidence and very little idea of what to make of it. However, there have been some interesting hypotheses based on various pieces of evidence. Number 1. Time of death. Initially declared to have occurred at 2 a.m., but numerous individuals state this was highly unlikely, given that he had a full pastry still in his stomach and had been seen motionless far before 2 a.m. So many now believe it was closer to 7:30 to 8 p.m., which lines up with the times around when the man was seen. This has opened doors to many more theories about the case. Number 2, the cigarette. Many have since pointed to the cigarette as the potential cause of death, which had never been discussed at the time. But, in fairness, they had no idea how complex this case would become during the initial autopsy. It's believed that it is very possible that, due to the pack being one brand of cigarettes, with a few cigarettes of another brand in the pack, that these could have been snuck into the pack by the possible murderer, and obviously, laced with poison. Oh, and that original autopsy? No one knows where it is. Number 3, the found copy of the Rubaiyat. During the investigation and for years since, the detectives looked for a copy of the book that was identical to the copy involved with the deceased. But despite exhaustive inquiries, they could not find a single exact match to this 7th edition copy of the book. Then it gets weirder. It was discovered that another man had died in Australia following the war. This man also had a copy of the Rubaiyat near him, and also a 7th edition copy of the book. Which again, surely just a coincidence. Well, except that over the years, multiple inquiries have been made to both the publisher and numerous libraries across the world, all of whom state that there were never more than 5 editions to the book. Which means that these books had to have been created by someone else for another purpose. And given that the anonymous man's copy had an apparent secret code on it, they suspect it could mean that this man was, in fact, a spy. Number 4, the code. Possibly the most repeatedly reviewed and investigated piece of evidence in this case. So many experts and amateurs out there are hoping to suddenly find the connection that so many others had missed. In 2004, the only guess with any relevance was regarding a portion of the final line of the text. ITTMTSAMSTGAB, which is what the final line read. They believed it to be some sort of acronym. The first portion, meaning, it's time to move to South Australia, Mosley Street, which is only relevant because that is where the woman, Jestyn, had lived, whose phone number was on the book. It's a stretch, but they'll take what they can get. Number 5, Jestyn. Or her real name, Jessica Thompson, which was later revealed under further investigation. This has perhaps been the most promising aspect to the case. Professors and various experts in their field have been following up on the hypotheses presented that the Somerton man was romantically involved with Jessica Thompson. There are various theories on the relationship between these two, some suggesting they were both spies, some suggesting they were soon to be married, and many believe that the Somerton man may have committed suicide or been murdered as a result of his anger of not being able to see his son, Robin. Scientists have looked at the image of the Somerton man and photos of Robin Thompson and found that each had 2 identical abnormalities. Both possessed the same rare and unusual ear structure and a rare genetic disorder which changed the structure of their teeth. Either feature would have been rare enough, but together, the likelihood of this being a coincidence is between 1 in 10 million and 1 in 20 million. So, there's that. There are so many other aspects that amateur sleuths and professionals are looking into these days, none of which would provide the full picture. This case almost feels like a movie. Just each mystery uncovered, revealing a new mystery. It's unbelievable. As of the year 2020, we still have no idea who the Somerton man was, what killed him, or whether his death was a murder or a suicide. However, there is some hope on the horizon, oddly enough. Professor Derek Abbott of the University of Adelaide began a full-on investigation of all aspects of the mystery, most notably regarding the potential use of DNA to find the identity of the man, or at least learn more about him. In 2011, Abbott's request for exhuming the body was declined due to there needing to be more substantial reasoning behind this request beyond public curiosity. Abbott felt like this was perhaps a dead end then, as she began focusing on other parts of the investigation. Until, in 2017, a thought occurred to Abbott, as she requested an inspection of the original casts made of both the man's face and upper torso. Let's just say she found exactly what she'd hoped for. She found within the mask 3 excellent hairs that would be perfect for DNA extraction. The results were returned, and amongst the results, it was found that the man's DNA belonged to a group possessed by only 1% of Europeans. With this new information, in late 2019, the Attorney General of Southern Australia finally granted Abbott's request for an exhumation. But, given the events of 2020, this exhumation has not yet occurred. With both DNA from the deceased and DNA from Jessica Thompson's living granddaughter, they're hoping to finally prove the theory that the Somerton man was the father of Jessica's son, Robin. Isn't it crazy to think that this time next year, a significant aspect of a 72-year-old investigation could be definitively proven? The world's pretty amazing, huh? If you want to learn more about this case, please take the time to look it up online. It is absolutely worth it. There are so many smaller details and theories I couldn't have possibly had time for, as this will already be my longest episode to date. So there is definitely more to learn in this case if you'd like to do your own research. On my end, I'll be sure and post amazing photos related to this case on my Twitter, so you all can see some of the locations and evidence that were so important in this case. Thank you again for listening to this episode of Anomalous Fascination. If you'd like to keep in touch with the show, you can find me at AnomalyPod on Twitter, or email me at anomalousfascination@gmail.com. And if you love the show, hop on Apple Podcasts and leave the show a nice 5-star rating and review. It goes a long way. And until next time, thanks for listening.